Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1067, Socialists for Trump and Hitler, part 7. This is being recorded on April 9th of the year 2019. This series has, well, expanded. I wouldn't say dragged on, but it has expanded beyond what I had initially envisioned as we begin exploring the political forces that are manifesting in the form, at least for the time being, of the left, quote, slash progressive wing of the Democratic Party. We have dealt with the individual whom I refer to as St. Bernard. That's Bernie Sanders. Of course, a St. Bernard is a very large dog that rules. And I think Bernie Sanders is in much the same category. I don't think he is actually a conscious agent. I think he is full of himself and a leftist ideologue. And beyond that, he's just not very bright. His followers and their demonstrations on his behalf notwithstanding. You take a look at the people around him, and so many of them are the antithesis of what one would expect if he were the, quote, progressive, unquote, that he professes to be. I think he is sincere. I don't think he is dissembling, but I think he is stupid, immature, and more than a little full of himself at this point. He is an ideologue. And in my experience, ideologues, Marxists of their various iterations, and he has a Trotskyite background, whether they're Marxist, Marxist-Leninist, Trotskyite, Stalinist, Maoist, or whatever, they have much in common, in my opinion, with religious fundamentalists. These are people who don't, for the most part, really want to think. They want to wake up in the morning knowing what they will be thinking all day long, and they have a tendency to fit the complexities of life into their pre-existing ideological or religious schemata. Sooner or later, however, as the old saying has it, their dogma gets run over by their karma, and I think that is going to happen with the so-called progressive wing of the Democratic Party. They are already starting a war within the Democratic Party that they had predicted they would do. And I, as I've delved into this series, I believe very strongly in what I'm talking about and the significance of having Sekhat Chakraborty, the driving force behind AOC, wearing Subhas Chandra Bose t-shirts, and networking with Cenk Uygur, who has a history of denying the Turkish genocide against the Armenians. That is more than a little significant. However, in the contemporary political and historical context, in particular with young people having had very poor educations, by and large at least, historically, and with a media and online life that is, attenuated and very badly structured, I could appreciate how having Sekhat Chakraborty appearing on social media with a Subhas Chandra Bose t-shirt, or having Cenk Uygur manifesting a history of denial of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians, I could see young people today saying something along the lines of what Hitler said as he was prepping his forces for the invasion of Poland in 1939. He observed, "Who today talks of the extermination of the Armenians?" And I can see a lot of young people may be saying that through no necessary fault of their own. It would appear to them to be a trivial and perhaps irrelevant detail. But this is neither trivial nor irrelevant. By the way, I thought it might be worth reinforcing how significant Subhas Chandra Bose was. His gravitas, due in no small measure to the importance of India, not only to the British Empire, but its geopolitical significance with a huge population, very important natural resources, and positioned very strategically at the southern end of the Earth Island or World Island, with profound geopolitical situationing or location vis-a-vis the Arabian Sea and other bodies of water. India was terribly important. Subhas Chandra Bose's gravitas within the Axis was such that, as we have seen, he was able to not only network with, but log FaceTime with Adolf Hitler, Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler. Ultimately, Bose's European combatants were folded into the Waffen-SS. He also logged FaceTime with Benito Mussolini and with Prime Minister General Hideki Tojo and with Japanese Emperor Hirohito. That, by the way, that is spelled H-I-R-O-H-I-T-O. Most people pronounce it Hirohito. It is actually pronounced Hirohito. Again, this isn't some little guy. And if Sekhat Chakraborty was some ignoramus, one might be able to gloss over the fact that he is doing appearances with Subhas Chandra Bose T-shirts. And as someone educated at Harvard, a native, by the way, of Fort Worth, Texas, and someone who became a multimillionaire on Wall Street and Silicon Valley, and then in 2016 he suddenly got religion and had to hook up with the Vermont socialist Bernie Sanders. Sekhat Chakraborty is the force behind AOC. He was her campaign manager. He is her chief of staff. He is the founder or co-founder of both political action committees, which between them donated a little under $1 million to a political consultancy that he also heads. He is, for all intents and purposes, AOC. And if he were an ignoramus, it would be one thing, but this guy's from Harvard, and people in India know full well who Subhas Chandra Bose was and what he stood for. Again, Bose's gravitas within the Axis was such that he logged FaceTime with Adolf Hitler, Heinrich Himmler, Benito Mussolini, Prime Minister General Hideki Tojo, and Emperor Hirohito of Japan themselves. As we are about to see, when Bose began doing propaganda broadcasts for Goebbels' propaganda ministry, the BBC countered him with broadcasts by someone, a writer, who broadcast under the name Eric Blair. Eric Blair was a nom de guerre, basically a broadcast pseudonym for George Orwell, the well-known author of 1984 and Animal Farm. A little bit more about Subhas Chandra Bose before we go into Alexandria Ocasio-Bose, as I've called her. From the Warfare History Network of November 11th of 2018 by Blaine, B-L-A-I-M-E, Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, Subhas Chandra Bose, champion of Indian nationalism. Known to his many followers as the Netaji, respected leader of the Azad Hind or Free India movement, Bose was called the darling of the Axis, unquote, by his biographer Marshall J. Goetz in Subhas Chandra Bose, 2004. Having met with Hitler, Italian fascist Duce Benito Mussolini, and Japanese Premier General Hideki Tojo. Those was, at one time or another, backed by all three of the major Axis powers. By 1943, he also held a trio of titles. Skipping down. After talking about the fact that ultimately his European combatant forces, BOSES, that is, were folded into the Waffen-SS. And again, Boeselog FaceTime with Heinrich Himmler, as well as with Hitler, Mussolini, the Emperor of Japan, and Prime Minister General Tojo. Skipping down. Boes set up the Free India Center in Berlin and began radio broadcasts from Nauen, N-A-U-E-N, Germany, to his far-off homeland on February 19th of 1942. Boes's British Broadcasting Corporation rival and counterpart author Eric Blair, a.k.a. George Orwell of Animal Farm and 1984 fame, led the Allied propaganda team that fought Boes over the radio. On March 1st, 1942, Free India declared war on the United Kingdom. Skipping down. Subhas Chandra Bose was smuggled out of the Third Reich in a German U-boat bound for the Far East. In Tokyo, Bose shook hands with General Tojo and got yet another lease on political life. Now, nominal leader of the new Japanese Indian National Army that had a Nipponese field marshal as chief of staff, Bose hailed Imperial Japan as the liberator of both Asia and India. Skipping down. Bose was formally declared president of Azad Hind, or Free India, on October 21st of 1943. His core belief was that World War II gave India the chance to liberate itself. Like Il Duce and the Führer before him, Bose now claimed the multiple titles and offices of head of state, prime minister, minister of war, and head of the foreign office. On the 23rd, the new chief executive officer made a state visit to Japan's Emperor Hirohito during the Greater East Asia Conference in Tokyo, while Premier Tojo ceded the islands of Andaman and Nicobar to Bose's new regime. Again, indicative of the gravitas that Bose had within the Axis. When you see someone with those kinds of political idols, as Sekhar Chakraborty clearly does, and then you see him as, for all intents and purposes, the driving force behind AOC, it should set people to thinking. And my take for, well, almost from the get-go was that not just Bernie Sanders, but the quote left, unquote, note the quotes of the Democratic Party was simply the latest iteration of a decades-old program that had been realized by the Republican Party in combination with elements of CIA and the intelligence community to game the American electoral landscape. This against the background not only of the assassinations of Martin Luther King and John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, but against the background of the media role in the portrayal of those killings, as we discussed in our huge series of interviews with Jim DiGenio, the author of Destiny Betrayed. And sure enough, the war within the Democratic Party that was promised by these, quote, leftists, unquote, is underway and in full swing. This is exactly what the Republicans want. We have seen, by the way, there has been quite a bit of discussion of Sekhar Chakraborty and his Subhas Chandra Bose t-shirt in the right-wing slash alt-right blogosphere. Fox News made some discussion of it. Upon reflection, by the way, I think Fox News almost certainly got that from the right-wing /alt-right blogosphere. There has been no even acknowledgement of this in the so-called progressive wing of the Democratic Party. My guess is that they will not discuss it. It remains to be seen if the Trump campaign brings this up in the 2020 campaign in combination with the already evident Republican gambit of trying to portray the Democrats as anti-Semitic, focusing on the idiotic pronouncements of Ilhan Omar, whom I suspect fronts for the Muslim Brotherhood. The Trump administration has been openly networking with and courting the favor of Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the embodiment of the fascist element in Israel and the Zionist movement. This is not to say that either Israel or the Zionist movement are fascist, but there is a fascist element within it, and it has grown in prominence, and I will update that at some point in the not-too-distant future. Yeah, this is the whole subject of the Israel-Palestinian conflict is something I hate to talk about because invariably you get it from both sides, but that is something that needs to be done. It would not surprise me one bit to see Trump bringing up Sekhat Chakrabarty and his Subhas Chandra Bose T-shirts in the campaign if the Democrats and the so-called progressive sector do not somehow find a way to address that. I think they're going to be caught flat-footed. I think the so-called progressive sector is very likely to retreat, as I indicated in an earlier program, to a position of Orientalism, and they'll see Subhas Chandra Bose as an Indian freedom fighter, which in one sense he was, but he allied himself with the Axis in order to do that and was quite prominent within the Axis pantheon. Again, I think that with people like Cenk Uygur, with a history of denying the Turkish genocide against the Armenians, and people like Sekhat Subhas Chandra Bose Chakrabarty, being the driving forces behind people like AOC and the so-called progressive sector. Well, I think we are looking at yet another manifestation of a decades-old tactic of dividing the Democrats using covert operations and extreme leftists to divide the Democratic Party. The New York Times Western edition of Monday, April 8th of 2019, this was yesterday, has an article by Katie Edmondson, E-D-M-O-N-D-S-O-N, House Campaign Arm and Liberal Wing at Odds Over Shielding Centrists. Before I read this, I want to remind people that once again, it was the moderate or centrist Democrats who enabled the Democrats to regain control of the House of Representatives by winning districts that were taken by Donald Trump in 2016. In our discussions with Jindy Eugenio, one of the things that I emphasized most strongly was the role of the media working seamlessly with the intelligence community, the criminal justice system, and the Department of Justice in Washington to basically cover up the assassination of President Kennedy and to Deep Six Jim Garrison's investigation. The reason we are hearing so much about people like Ilhan Omar and Bernie Sanders and AOC is because this is who the media are presenting to us. There was, as I mentioned in an earlier program in this series, there was a letter to the New York Times that said, well, thank God there has finally been some mention in this newspaper about the moderate Democrats, because indeed, if one were to read the American media, you're going to hear about Bernie, you're going to hear about AOC, you're going to hear about Ilhan Omar. You are not hearing about the Democrats who enabled the Democrats to regain control of the House of Representatives because they are more moderate or, quote, centrist, unquote. And in keeping with their promises, sure enough, the Sekat Chakrabarty AOC Justice Democrats and allied elements are once again splitting, they're working to split the Democratic Party in the name of social justice. I think, that is why I titled this series Socialists for Trump and Hitler. Again, from the Western edition of the New York Times, Monday, April 8th of 2019, House campaign arm and liberal wing at odds over shielding centrists. It reads in part, the House Democratic campaign arm is nearing open warfare with the party's rising liberal wing as political operatives close to Speaker Nancy Pelosi try to shut down primary challenges before what is likely to be a hard-fought campaign next year to preserve the party's shaky majority. Skipping down. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, who owes her seat to a successful primary challenge, went so far as to encourage her 3.8 million Twitter followers to, quote, pause, unquote, their donations to the campaign committee. Skipping down. House Democrats had divided over single-payer Medicare for All versus incremental legislation to balance the to bolster the Affordable Care Act, and over Ms. Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal versus less ambitious climate change policies. Liberal Democrats and more moderate newcomers from Republican-leaning districts have fought over Republican procedural motions. Skipping down. And this is Ms. Bustos is Sherry Bustos. Ms. Bustos's rule, B-U-S-T-O, by the way, Ms. Bustos's rule prohibits Democratic consultants and vendors working for a primary challenger to an incumbent from receiving work from the committee. It comes as ardent liberal organizations like Justice Democrats, read Subhas Chandra Chakrabarty. It comes as ardent, quote, it should be quote liberal, unquote. It comes as ardent liberal organizations like Justice Democrats, emboldened by a pair of high-profile wins in 2018, Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts and Ms. Ocasio-Cortez are aggressively gearing up to challenge centrist or old-line Democrats with liberal candidates. And skipping down. One group, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, said Friday that it was exploring a challenge to Representative Richard E. Neal of Massachusetts, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, because he has not committed to holding hearings on the single-payer health care system known as Medicare for All. At the helm of that panel, Mr. Neal has been on the front lines of conducting oversight on President Trump's finances, and last week requested 6 years of his personal tax returns. Quote, listen to this. We reject the DCCC's attempt to hoard power, which will only serve to keep that talent pool and Congress itself disproportionately white and male, unquote. Maria Urbina, U-R-B-I-N-A, the National Political Director for Indivisible, a progressive grassroots group, said of the campaign committee. Indivisible is one of the organizations that has received funding from Leah Hunt Hendricks. That is H.L. Hunt's granddaughter, H.L. Hunt, the right-wing John Birch Society fascist Texas billionaire whose sons Lamar and Nelson Bunker Hunt followed in his footsteps. He, by the way, H.L. Hunt, was helping to finance the Nation of Islam, and among the reasons that Malcolm X broke with Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam was over H.L. Hunt's role in bankrolling the Nation of Islam. Because shortly after that, Malcolm X was assassinated. Indivisible is one of the groups that is being financed by H.L. Hunt's granddaughter, and I simply do not believe that suddenly she got religion. I don't believe that at all. I think she is following in the footsteps of H.L. Hunt, who, among other things, funded groups that would split the political opposition, in this case, the Nation of Islam. Skipping down. Many of the candidates wooed in the last campaign cycle by Justice Democrats would have run in districts that lean Republican. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee had to work hard to beat those challenges back, worried that a triumph by Justice Democrats in the primary would have cost the party a possible victory in the general election. And this, I believe, is exactly the goal of the likes of Sekhat Chakrabarty, AOC at all. I do not think that there is anything sinister about AOC other than the fact that she is profoundly immature and very full of herself. I think there is something absolutely sinister with a capital A and a capital S about Sekhat Chakrabarty, and I believe that there is something absolutely sinister as well about Cenk Uygur, the what Armenian genocide, who co-founded Brand New Congress with Subhas Chandra Chakrabarty. One of the things that is to be noted in this context is that of Subhas Chandra Bose, repeating something that we went into in our last program, Subhas Chandra Bose appears to have gone underground at the end of World War II. He did not die, as was reported very quickly from History Today, Volume 60, Issue 11 by Hugh, H-U-G-H, Purcell, P-U-R-C-E-L-L. Subhas Chandra Bose, The Afterlife of India's Fascist Leader. Skipping down. Although Netaji Great Leader Bose was reported killed in an air crash in August of 1945, many believed then and continue to believe now that, helped by his Japanese allies, he faked his death and returned to India many years later to lead the secret life of a hermit. Skipping down. In his inquiry report, this is on Subhas Chandra Bose's death, in his inquiry report completed in 2006, Justice Mukherjee, M-U-K-H-E-R-J-E-E, was categoric. He concluded, quote, Netaji Bose is dead, a safe bet, as he would have been 109. He did not die in the plane crash as alleged, and the ashes in the Japanese temple in Tokyo maintained by the Indian government since 1945 are not those of Netaji. This is more than a little significant, in my opinion, and we're going to go into the possibility that a Bosist or Bosian political underground may have been continued, very possibly as part of Cold War policy. We're going to examine the Ananda Marga or Anand Marg cult, and reiterating from our last program, from Violence and New Religious Movements by James R. Lewis, speaking of Sarkar, Subhas Chandra Bose's nephew and someone who lived with him during his period of collaboration with the Axis, Sarkar was interested in the Indian struggle for home rule and had a maternal family tie to Indian independence fighter Netaji Subhas Chandra Bose, who was his uncle. One of Sarkar's most important books on social philosophy, Problems of the Day, 1959, is dedicated to Bose with the following inscription, quote, to the great hero Subhas Chandra Bose, whom I did love and whom I do love even now, unquote. Like Bose, Sarkar was a believer in armed struggle, and he fashioned the ideology of his movement accordingly. And more about the Anand Marg and Subhas Chandra Bose link. There is an organization called Prout, P-R-O-U-T, which is an acronym for Progressive Utilization Theory. And from one of their websites, what is the link between Prout and Ananda Marga. And skipping down in that, we read, this theory blends spiritual with socialistic idealism, a formula familiar for Eastern India, where prominent nationalists such as Vivekananda and Subhas Chandra Bose also made use of the present Ananda Marga slogan, liberation of self and service to humanity. More about Ananda Marga in our next show. I would note that although this is not directly relevant to the going underground or the apparent going underground of Subhas Chandra Bose and the official Indian judicial investigation concluded in 2006 into his death, concluded that he did not die in that plane crash. By the way, he was flying out of Saigon in what was then Japanese-occupied French Indochina. Of course, it became the capital of South Vietnam, well known to people in the Vietnam War generation. We're going to go back to the fall of 1985, and we are going to listen to a portion of AFA program number 11. Although this is not directly relevant to the apparent going underground of Subhas Chandra Bose, it does present the political and historical context in which Bose's apparent going underground took place, bearing in mind that Bose was a prominent Axis combatant. After having declared war on and fought against the Allies, he would not have just been able to return to India above ground. But at this point in time, in mid-August of 1945, and in September of 1945, Axis forces all over the world, including in Asia, were being recruited for service to the former World War II allies in the Cold War against the former Soviet Union and against China. I would note that India is a highly diverse country, and in many of many provinces have different languages, and in some of them there are very prominent communist parties that have wielded significant influence in the post-World War II and post-independence period. Those would necessarily have become targets of Cold War and British and U.S. intelligence activity. So we're going to go back to the fall of 1985, and we're going to listen to the death of John Birch and the context in which John Birch, for whom the John Birch Society, one of whose most prominent members was H.L. Hunt, the grandfather of one of the financiers of the, quote, liberal, unquote, wing of the Democratic Party. We're going to listen to the circumstances surrounding his death, noting that John Birch and many other elements associated with U.S. intelligence at this point were actively recruiting combatant forces who had fought against the U.S. on behalf of the Japanese and or the Japanese themselves. This from AFA number 11 from the fall of 1985. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my former co-host Nip Tuck, whose on-air capabilities and brilliance were fundamental to the execution of the AFA and other archive shows.
Continuing now with OSS by R. Harris Smith. OSS officers were the first to see the absurdity of this dream of neutrality, unquote. In April of 1945, 46 OSS men had set up headquarters in an old Seventh-day Adventist mission at Siam in North China, some 150 miles south of Yunnan. In early August, the German-American colonel who commanded the group, he was selected for the post because the local Chinese warlord had been educated in Berlin, began dispatching his OSS teams into the field. These units encountered difficulties with Japanese and Chinese troops of all descriptions. There was a thin line, for example, between Kuomintang loyalists and the Chinese puppet soldiers who had fought for the Japanese. One team, commanded by a 24-year-old Jedberg — Jedbergs, by the way, were a group of OSS commandos who had operated in Western Europe — commanded by a 24-year-old Jedberg, parachuted to their drop zone to find their reception committee composed of a group of Chinese who were paid by the Japs, got their arms from the Japs, and might easily be loyal to them. The local warlord had commanded a division for the Chinese nationalist government, and when he was captured by the Japs, he commanded a division for them with the same aplomb and good nature. It was our information that he was still in correspondence with Chiang Kai-shek and would help if he didn't risk his own neck. These puppet troops were only a temporary problem. When the war ended, the warlord generals who had been traitors to their country abruptly realigned themselves with the Chiang government. The Chungking regime accepted their support as allies against the communists with open arms. OSS had also become inadvertently concerned about growing communist strength. In the last months of the war, two OSS teams dispatched from Siam to the guerrilla zones were arrested by communist troops. In both cases, the Dixie mission at Yunnan secured their release. It appeared that local communist zealots had acted without approval of communist headquarters. Then in August, dozens of OSS intelligence officers were sent into the northern hinterland from Siam to report on local military conditions. Communist troops, who saw these teams as tools of the Kuomintang, deliberately harassed the Americans. Now, it's against this background that we're going to take a look at what happened to John Birch. Now, John Birch was basically the U.S. intelligence advisor to Chiang Kai-shek, okay, and not to Chiang Kai-shek, but to General Claire Chennault of the Flying Tigers. And he also was working for the OSS. And so that the death of John Birch is what we're going to focus on here. But one of the things that to keep in mind here was that in China at this time, you had a situation where what they refer to here as puppet troops were, at first, fighting against the Japanese, then cheerfully jumped to the Japanese cause, being traitors to their own country, and then were welcomed by Chiang Kai-shek with open arms. This obviously creates sort of a muddied situation, but basically you have Chinese puppet troops switching uniforms to the Japanese and then back to the Chinese government. Because these puppet troops are going to figure in the death of John Birch here in just a minute.
Okay, and we are going to reread a segment from, and I wrote this down and I pop this back here somewhere. I'm back a couple.
This is from The Nightmare Decade by Fred Cook.
That's right. Okay. Again, a segment from The Nightmare Decade talking about not only the puppet troops, but in fact the Japanese themselves who, again, those of you not familiar with the Chinese theater, and this is why I suggest you read some of the well-known historians like Barbara Tuchman, will not be aware of the numerous and hideous atrocities that were performed in China by the Japanese. They were the outrage of the world before World War II actually started, and were just really famous. Millions and millions and millions of dollars were raised in the United States, but just by the pictures that were being printed by such people as the Time Empire people, the Luces and others, showing the devastation wrought in Nanking and Chungking and other places by the Japanese invaders.
And very recently, in fact, the Chinese government has been commemorating what military historians refer to as the Rape of Nanking, which Nip Tuck talked about, and it's been in the news lately, and one of the points they made was in that one city alone, 340,000 Chinese were killed, which is roughly equal to the number of Japanese who died in both of the atomic bombings, which have been, of course, a subject of a lot of discussion recently. And it's worth noting that these 340,000 did not die in a thermonuclear blast. They were bayoneted to death, shot to death, beheaded, and so forth, in just an orgy of atrocity that, as Nip Tuck very accurately told you, just was the outrage of the world at that time. Chinese were used for, living Chinese were used for bayonet practice and so forth. So, just imagine the effect that had upon the Chinese consciousness.
And again, one of the reasons that General Joseph Stilwell was so upset with Chiang Kai-shek was because America, principally America, was sending millions and millions of dollars of lend-lease aid to Chiang Kai-shek to fight the Japanese, who were devastating his country and slaughtering his countrymen by the hundreds of thousands. And Chiang Kai-shek instead was supporting his vast family and friends in high style, while much of the money was just being siphoned off to graft and corruption. And even more of it, though, was going into stockpiling military equipment for Chiang Kai-shek to destroy the communists after the war ended. And in fact, he had very little intentions of fighting the Japanese at all. Okay, going back to The Nightmare Decade by Fred Cook. When the war ended, China was in utter chaos. Thousands of Japanese troops wandered around the countryside fully armed, with no one accepting their surrender. John F. Melby, in a day-by-day diary he kept at the time, reflected in bewilderment upon this anomaly. On December 27, 1945, he noted, quote, "I still don't understand about the Japanese. Officially, they are being disarmed. But the fact is, they never seem to be. In Shanghai, 15,000 still walk the streets with full equipment. In Nanking, the high Japanese generals are bosom buddies of the Chinese. In the north, tens of thousands of Japanese soldiers are used to guard railroads and warehouses and to fight the communists. If you ask what this is all about, the answer is either a denial or, in more candid moments, a shh, we don't talk about that. In another entry on January 30th, 1947, a good 16 months after VJ Day, 16 months, mind you, almost a year and a half, Melby noted that, though it was being kept, quote, very quiet, there were 80,000 holdout Japanese troops in eastern and northwestern Manchuria who are fully equipped fighting the communists. So almost a year and a half after VJ Day, 80,000 troops fighting the communists on behalf of Chiang Kai-shek.
Recall, this is very similar to something that we looked at on the Western Front in Europe, where guerrilla groups that were set up by the Third Reich and under the command of the OKW, German Army High Command, basically fought a fierce guerrilla warfare in the rear of the Red Army as the Germans were retreating. Although originally set up by the Third Reich, they continued their war until the early 1950s, and the sponsorship of these guerrilla groups basically went to the CIA through the Gehlen Organization, now Hitler's Eastern Front Intelligence Organization, which we absorbed in the end of the war. So basically, what you had here in China was the same thing that you had in Western Europe, which was a continuation of the combat. You had the Chinese communists who were fighting the Japanese throughout the war, and then, and also the Chinese puppet troops, and then with VJ Day on August 8th, 1945, the Japanese troops continued their fighting only simply on behalf of the Chinese nationalists and, by extension, the United States at this point. Ditto for the Chinese puppet troops who simply jumped to Japanese when it served them and became traitors and then jumped back to Chiang Kai-shek when it became more convenient. So the fighting continues throughout the war, and only there's basically a nominal change of uniforms. But it's important to understand that there was a continuation of combat in China here during the early years after World War II. And in particular here, for our purposes, it's worth noting that the Japanese troops, one of the things they were used for was guarding railroads, because we're going to take a look at that here in just a second. Now, to the career, or the death, really, of John Birch. Now, I'm going to read you a short section here from a book called The John Birch Society in California Politics, published by the Publius Society, or Publius, P-U-B-L-I-U-S, copyrighted 1966 by Brian W. Stevens. Research credit on this goes to Mae Brussel, by the way. Mae is the top researcher in this field, and her World Watchers broadcast is aired on Sunday mornings at 9 and repeated Thursday evenings. That's tomorrow at 9 o'clock here on KFJC. About John Birch, in a chapter called, appropriately enough, Who Was John Birch?, Stevens writes as follows. John Birch was a young Baptist missionary in China when the Japanese occupied China during World War II. He served as intelligence advisor and interpreter for the Flying Tigers of General Claire Chennault until the Flying Tigers organization was integrated into the U.S. Army Air Corps. When the Army took over, Birch was commissioned a captain in the Army and continued his duties as intelligence officer for the Air Corps. At the end of the war, Birch was sent, with several Chinese, on a mission into territory held by the Chinese communists. He was killed on this mission. It's worth noting here, as we'll see in a minute, that he was actually working for the OSS at this time. And recall that we took a look at how the Nazi Party began as an intelligence front, and one of the things to look at here is how the people who are going to wind up in the John Birch Society or are associated with it in any way come from the military and intelligence communities. And take note also of General Claire Chennault's Flying Tigers. Those were the very famous fighter pilots who basically their shark-nosed P-40s became very famous during World War II. And Madame Chennault, really his widow, was a key element of the China lobby. But John Birch, in addition to working for OSS, is his intelligence advisor.
Yeah, it's while on one hand, the people who flew over the hump into China during the time that the Chinese were cut off from the ocean by the Japanese invasion are a justly famous, a heroic bunch, because the flying over the hump, over the mountains into China, was probably one of the most hazardous things in aviation at that time, and these were men who did this several times a week, sometimes several times in a day. And Chenault was undoubtedly a very brave flyer himself and his men, and they carried on for a long time themselves the war against the Japanese on behalf of the United States government when there was no official military commitment in China by the United States. However, on the other hand, as Dave mentioned, well, the name Chenault is a bit of a flag because later on, Chenault, who was a rabid supporter of Chiang Kai-shek, he and then especially his wife after he died became very, very early proponents of the China lobby and were among the people that helped to start the entire McCarthy era off on its way by their allegations about waffling in the State Department and lukewarm support for anti-communist governments like Chiang Kai-shek's and their and accusations of this sort. Anyway, back to John Birch again and his military and his intelligence background. Going to read a short segment here from a book called The Secret File on John Birch, written by James and Marty Heffley, H-E-F-L-E-Y, copyright 1980 by Tyndall House Publishers, Inc. Okay. Although official U.S. policy viewed the communist movement as an internal problem, the Heffleys write, the Chinese would have to solve for themselves. The American military had been on the scene long enough to realize the potential danger to peace in China. Wiedemeyer and the OSS men were determined the communists would not take advantage of the end-of-war confusion. When John, that's John Birch, and Miller kept their morning radio schedule on August 19th, they learned that both were bound for the same city, Suzhou, where a large Japanese headquarters facility and airfield was located. In the euphoria of knowing that the war was over, they disregarded code and talked openly about how they would get there. Quote, I'm taking a junk down the Yellow, meaning the Yellow River, to Pengpu, and I'll catch the train north to Suzhou from there, Miller said. Why not come with me? Skipping on down. The next morning, John, again John Birch, assembled his party. They included three other Americans, Lieutenant Laird Ogle, a specialist in morale intelligence, Sergeant Albert C. Myers, a radio technician, and Albert Grimes, a civilian OSS operative skilled in counter-espionage. Grimes wore a 14th Air Force captain's uniform and was second in command. Assisting the uniformed Americans were five Chinese officers and two Japanese-speaking Koreans who went along as interpreters. The group of 11 carried 27 pieces of baggage and three radios. One of the Chinese, Lieutenant Tung Fu Quan, was assigned as John Birch's aide. They left about 1 p.m., trekked northward to a town on the Yellow River, and took a junk, a day's journey northeast, to another point on the river. They again turned north, walking all night until they reached Kwe Te on the Lunghai Railroad about noon. Here they were received courteously by a Japanese commander, who assured them that they would be well received in Suzhou. However, he warned that the communist guerrillas were causing trouble along the railroad to the east. The group spent Wednesday and Thursday nights at Kwe Te, then proceeded with two Chinese who had been collaborating with the Japanese, General Peng and his orderly Lei Yuqing. General Peng was to escort them to his counterpart, the puppet General Ho, in Suzhou, in other words, another man who had been working for the Japanese. It was understood that John was still in command of the mission. They boarded an eastbound train at Kwe Te the next morning. John still believed the communists would not interdict an American mission on a main railroad line traveling under direct orders of General Wiedemeyer. They encountered no delay for the first 45 miles, then the train halted at Tangshan Station. After a few minutes of waiting, John sent the Koreans to ask the Japanese station master what was the holdup. The Koreans reported back that the line had been sabotaged ahead, and communists, Japanese, and Chinese puppet troops were also fighting in the area. Until the line was repaired and things calmed, the train would remain at Tangshan. Okay, skipping on down. They talk about a priest who came and a Portuguese Catholic priest came and told them that the communists had killed many of his men. John Birch and Ogle hurried back to the railroad and found a Japanese patrol had arrived on a handcar bringing replacement rails. Some of the Jap soldiers were pounding the new rails in place. Others had taken up defensive positions on both sides of the railroad as if they expected trouble. At John's request, the patrol commander directed his men to move the handcar over the break and load in the group's baggage. He and his men then escorted them to the station, where a large supply train was guarded by a garrison of about 600 Japanese troops.
Now, the rest of the story here basically is sort of consists of dialogue, reconstructed dialogue, as the Hefleys have sort of used it. As they state in the beginning of the book, the dialogue here is invented by them. The events are real, but they sort of used a little literary license, I guess you could say, to fill in the dialogue here. So the rest of this account of the death of John Birch's dialogue, we're not going to go read you the dialogue per se. We'll tell you basically what happened. John Birch, now recall his mission here, he's traveling along railway lines with active assistance from disarmed, I guess you could really regard them as turned, Japanese soldiers, because recall that we were meaning U.S. policy in that area through Chiang Kai-shek, was willing to enlist the armed support of the Japanese against the Chinese communists, in essence affecting a uniform switch, as we mentioned. Perhaps more importantly, John Birch, now recall that Wiedemeyer had authorized American forces, and in particular OSS, to accept the surrender of Japanese on behalf of Chiang Kai-shek, and this put them in direct conflict with the Chinese communists. And recall, of course, that throughout this time there's been a continuation of combat. In other words, this was 1 week to the day after VJ Day that John Birch died, and basically the fighting has gone on unabated. The fighting that had proceeded throughout World War II is still going on, only a nominal shift of uniforms on behalf of the Japanese, who are guarding railway lines here. And John Birch now is working with, among others, two Chinese puppet soldiers who have been collaborating with the Japanese, and specifically part of his mission was to escort them to the puppet General Ho in Suzhou, their ultimate destination. As seen here, these groups were receiving active aid from the Japanese, the very Japanese who had bombed Pearl Harbor and who had been America's enemies 1 week before, and who, as we mentioned, were involved in a continuous combat throughout this period, stretching, of course, throughout World War II and right up to this point. We're in August 15th, 1945. And that basically these are the people with whom John Birch was working and traveling. Now, what Birch went into Chinese territory was stopped by the Chinese, who took due note of his puppet associates and his association with the Japanese. However, they were quite willing to allow him to pass through their territory and to fulfill his request to meet with their commanding officer. The bone of contention was that they wanted to disarm Birch and his party. Birch and his party refused to be disarmed, and in fact, according to all accounts, some of Birch's own associates warned him that his attitude was a little too truculent. At any rate, eventually, the attempt to disarm them by the Chinese led to a fight, and there was shooting, and John Birch and several of the Chinese were killed. Okay, so but these are the circumstances under which Birch died. Basically, for all intents and purposes, fighting with the Axis here. He's working with Chinese puppet troops and Japanese troops. And note that the Japanese are fully armed here and are taking up defensive positions on this railroad. Then, when the Chinese communists want to disarm him, Birch stages an argument and is killed. So that is how John Birch died. Now, returning again to the John Birch Society in California Politics, an assessment of John Birch's death here from one of his OSS compatriots, again the author Brian W. Stevens. On Friday, March 31st, 1961, Joseph S. Sample, S-A-M-P-L-E, president of a radio and television company in Billings, Montana, and who served in the same Office of Strategic Services with John Birch, wrote in his byline column in the weekly Yellowstone News that John Birch was no hero and did not die in glory. Sample wrote, Birch was a man with no particularly distinguishing characteristics, a little stiff perhaps, but a not very high regard for the Chinese and somewhat self-important, but nothing unusual. If he had strong political convictions, they were not in evidence. Describing the situation in China in 1945, when civil war seemed inevitable, Sample said Birch was assigned a mission in central China. So basically, in the minds of at least one of his compatriots, he was no hero, and the circumstances we've already recited. He was basically acting on behalf of the Chiang Kai-shek government to accept the surrender of Japanese troops, working with Chinese puppet troops, and with Japanese who had been kept under arms and were continuing to fight, even though this was barely a week after the official Japanese surrender. And remember that the all covert operations were going through Wiedemeyer's office, and that Chiang's chief of military intelligence was Louis Siefkin.
That again from AFA program number 11, from the fall of 1985, in addition to my own voice, you also heard the voice of my brilliant former co-host, Nip Tuck. By the way, some of the historical context. Albert Cody Wiedemeyer had replaced General Stilwell as the American advisor to Chiang Kai-shek. Stilwell was openly critical of Chiang Kai-shek, whom he said the only difference between Chiang Kai-shek and Benito Mussolini was that Mussolini was better at what he did than Chiang Kai-shek was. Albert Kobe Wiedemeyer had very strong connections to the German General Staff, had studied at the German Kriegswehr Academy, the German equivalent of West Point, rented an apartment when in Germany from Gerhard Rosbach, who was the number two man in the SA, Ernst Röhm's brown shirts. Rosbach, by the way, went to work for the CIA in the post-World War II period. Wiedemeyer also was deeply implicated in the leaking of the Rainbow Five plan. That was America's mobilization and military campaign plans for entering the Second World War, and it was leaked prior to the war, and Albert Kobe Wiedemeyer was deeply implicated in the leak of those plans. Basically an act of treason, because of his right wing, some would say fascist sympathies. Wiedemeyer, replaced General Stilwell as the top American advisor to Chiang Kai-shek, and Wiedemeyer was presiding over the activities you heard. Now this again is the context in which Subhas Chandra Bose was apparently going underground. In our next program, I'm going to ruminate a little bit about the possibility of a post-war Bosean underground. We're going to take an extended look at the Ananda Marga or Anand Marg cult. And we're also going to ruminate a little bit about what some of these right-wing and fascist links to people like AOC and the milieu behind her and people like Bernie Sanders with Tulsi Gabbard of the Hare Krishna cult, who was arguably the main American contact point for Narendra Modi, and the BJP and the RSS, and who sits on the board of a Koch brothers-funded think tank with links to the neo-Confederate movement. We're going to ruminate about some of the implications of this and about the possibility of a Bosean underground and even the possibility of Subhas Chandra Bose as part of the Serpent's Walk revisionism of repositioning the Axis as heroes. However, that will have to wait for our next program. This concludes For the Record program number 1067, Socialists for Trump and Hitler, Part 7. This is being recorded on April 9th of the year 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.